Whether we're going to speak on a subject today that's well known to you. Nobody here doesn't know what the Abrahamic promise is. Nobody here doesn't know how fundamental it is to our understanding of the divine plan. Abraham, as you know, is here on the chart. And Abraham, therefore, starts in the patriarchal age. We're going to find in our examination of the promises and of the experiences with Abraham that maybe those four ages from the patriarchal age forward are going to be highlighted. We have the patriarchal age, the Jewish age, the gospel age, and of course the messianic age. And by the time the messianic age is complete, the blessings promised to Abraham will have been completed, not only to the church during the gospel age, but to the world of mankind during the kingdom. Now there's Abraham. If you didn't know what he looked like, now you do. I like this picture of him, but of course it's just an artist's rendition. And there's the promise. And I see shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Genesis 22, verse 18. Now that promise was not the first time that God had approached Abraham or given him what we consider to be the Abrahamic promise, but it is a very well-known statement of it. But the occasion of this was not the occasion when God first called Abraham. This was many years later. Abraham was called when he was still in Ur of the Chaldees. And this text was given when Abraham was in the promised land and when he had waited 25 years after that for the birth of a promised seed. And now this child has grown. And we don't know precisely how old he was, but he well may have been in his late 20s or 30s. And now God says, take your son, your only son, and offer him on one of the mountains of Moriah that I will show you. Now, the location that God told Abraham to go to is meaningful because that is the location where Jesus would later die. Because Mount Moriah is the area that we understand from King David was nearly what later became the temple area. And there's a kind of a mountain area with valleys. And the whole area is kind of the area of Moriah. So Jesus outside the city evidently was killed on Mount Moriah. Now, it does say in Genesis that when Abraham traveled on the third day, he lifted up his eyes and he saw the place afar off. Now, if you think about the days in God's plan, we often think in big periods that a day with the Lord is like 1,000 years. And if you count the years from Adam forward to the flood, and then from the flood forward to Abraham, you've gone beyond 2,000 years. So therefore, from the beginning of Adam, you are now on the third day. Now, the distance which Abraham prophetically saw when Jesus would die for our sins was a long ways off. So on the third day, he lifted up his eyes and he saw the place a long distance off. I think prophetic of the fact that on the third millennium, it was still a long ways off before Jesus would die. Now, on this occasion, when Abraham offered Isaac in sacrifice, Abraham was willing. He was, of course, very sad, but willing. I mean, this is what God told him to do. Now, various people have had different opinions about what the frame of Abraham's mind might have been. Maybe Abraham thought, well, there's only one way out of this. God will raise my son from the dead when he's offered. I don't know. We don't really know, but we do know this. We know that Abraham was willing to be obedient to an incontrovertible command by the Heavenly Father under the most distressful circumstance. And there is an account, a thought in Jewish culture, a custom in Jewish culture, that maybe this was a cleavage point between Sarah and Abraham. I don't know. I don't know how much Abraham divulged to his wife what was going to happen on this trip. Would wisdom suggest he not? But there's no chance that he misunderstood God. If there was any chance he misunderstood him, he would, of course, clarify that issue. And so they're on their way. And so when they're on their way, he takes his son Isaac with him. And in chapter 22 of verse 6, it says, Abraham took the wood This is chapter 22, verse 6. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac, his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and both went up with them together. So I think when Isaac was climbing Mount Moriah with wood on his back, you can't help but remember that Jesus climbed Mount Moriah with a wood on his back. Now, there was a time when Jesus stumbled and fell, and he couldn't maintain it. And so Simon the Cyrene helped him out. He was forced into the issue, but I think that forcing of Simon into the issue was good for Simon, because later on, I think he was a disciple. And so Christ died for us, but we sometimes get the opportunity to bear our cross as well. So Isaac has a question, of course. In verse 7, Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, well, here's the wood fire, there's the wood, we're missing a lamb for a burnt offering. And Abraham just said, God will provide them. And of course, then it became clear as time went by what was the intent. But notice what kind of an offering this was. It was a burnt offering. Now, as it turns out, you know the story. You know that after Abraham was stayed by his hand with an angel, that then they saw a ram caught in the thicket. And a ram is very frequently the kind of offering that is called a burnt offering. But in the Old Testament, there are three kinds of offerings. You could say more, but I'm trying to lump them into the basic kinds of offering. There was a burnt offering, and if you look in Leviticus, let me give you a little background here about Leviticus, how it starts. when you look at the book of Exodus, just before Leviticus, the last chapter of Exodus is chapter 40. Now, I remember that because there were 40 years in the wilderness, and Exodus is about the wilderness, you know. So the 40th chapter, it says, on the first day of the first month of the second year of their travel, you're going to set up the tabernacle. Now, everything was ready for the tabernacle before that, but God said deliberately, wait until the first day of the first month of the next year before you set it up. And then that day came, and he says in the 40th chapter, okay, now set it up. So they set up the tabernacle. They got everything ready, but now there's a problem. We don't have a priesthood. And in order to inaugurate the priesthood, you've got to do sacrifices. But how do you do the sacrifices? That's where Exodus ends. And now you flip the page to Leviticus. And the first six or seven chapters of Leviticus, what you have is, this is how you do sacrifices. And that's why we learn that the burnt offering is the fundamental offering of all. That's the very first offering that's described in Leviticus chapters 1-7. Now, these seven chapters go through the offerings of God twice. They go through the offerings the first time with the basic way you do it, and then in the last chapter and a half, it goes through them again with specifics that are relevant to the priesthood in particular. But that's a detail that we don't have to be concerned with here too much. But the burnt offering, and then after that, there's a peace offering, and after that, there's a sin offering. Those are the three kinds of offerings in the divine plan. Now, the burnt offering was unusual because it's the only offering that went right on the wood. Now, if the wood represents the wood of the cross, what is the offering that goes right on the cross? That's the offering of our Lord Jesus. That's the offering that was fully consumed in the sacrifice. And I think that's the ransom. Now, we often think of the burnt offering as representing acceptance, and I think there's a key here that's correct. And that is, the ransom makes everything else acceptable. So this is a burnt offering. Isaac was a burnt offering. Now, a peace offering, by contrast, means a devotion. Well, Jesus was devoted. He was a peace offering. But that's not the point here. The point here is that he was an atonement offering. And in Leviticus, the first three or four verses, it says the burnt offering makes atonement for your soul. So this Isaac was a burnt offering on Mount Moriah. I think that is the ransom. And now on this occasion, when the ram, you know, in the thicket replaced Isaac, but it was still the symbol of the ransom. Then, because Abraham was faithful, in verse 15, Genesis 22:15, the angel of Jehovah called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, by myself have I sworn, saith Jehovah, because you have done this thing and has not withheld thy son, thine only son. In blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand of the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. In thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Now, fundamentally, it's because Jesus died as a ransom that all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And the seed is going to be not only earthly in the kingdom, but spiritual and the stars of heaven as well. But you notice that this is the occasion where God took the opportunity to seal this promise with an oath. Now, Paul makes a point of that in the book of Hebrews. He says, by two immutable things, we have positive assurance of what God's plan is. First of all, that he gave his word. Now, if God appeared to you and gave his word, you wouldn't doubt it. But then you're all people of faith, you know, and you understand, and Abraham believed too. But now if God appeared a second time and he says, I swear by myself, then you say, okay, well, no question here. And that's what Paul says, by two immutable things, by his word and by his oath. And because he could swear by none greater, he swore by himself. And we have, therefore, a positive assurance of what God's plans and purposes are. Now, there is something more about the burnt offering I'd just like to mention, and that is, if you turn briefly to Romans, the fourth chapter, you'll see the connection, perhaps, between the burnt offering and some others. The fourth chapter of Romans, at the very end, it says, in verse 24, it was, if she be imputed to us, if we believed on him that raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was delivered for our offenses and raised again for our justification. Therefore, being justified, how are we justified? By faith in the redeeming blood of Jesus. Being justified, chapter 5, verse 1, we have peace, by whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand, and rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Now, that's something the world has no clue about. This is the heavenly calling. This is the hope of glory beyond. Once we've been justified, then we have peace. What's the next offering? A peace offering. What is a peace offering all about? It means once you have peace with God, you can now devote yourselves to his service. And I think that's the connection Paul saw. And I think when he said justification and then peace, he's thinking in his own mind. The justification we have in the sacrifice of Christ is the burnt offering. And then the next thing offered, the next thing discussed, is the peace offering. A peace offering does not bring peace between you and God. The burnt offering did that. It brought atonement. The peace offering is an offering you make. Now that you have peace, you can then devote yourself to his service. And I think that's the connection here in Romans. You're justified by faith. Now you have peace. And now you have something so wonderful, you could tell your neighbor and they think you were crazy. You have the opportunity to become part of the Messiah class, as it were, in the kingdom, to bless all the families of the earth. Okay, we're going to go on a little bit further. Now, we're going to distinguish here the various classes. Now, some of these distinctions you know. You could tell them to me before I just asked a few questions. But you know that when we talk about the stars of heaven, we usually are thinking about the spiritual class as distinct from the sand of the seashore. Now, it's interesting to notice when these various expressions were made and on what occasions. Now, you see there on the chart, the first mention of the stars of heaven is way back in Genesis, the 15th chapter. What is the subject of Genesis 15? Well, if you turn there and you see what was the context, it says in chapter 15, verse 1, that God said, I am your exceeding shield and great reward. And Abraham said, oh, okay, well, that's good. I know, no question about that. But he's got a question. I'd have the same question. This was years later, after they're entered the land. He says, well, what will you give me, seeing I go childless and this steward of my house, Eliezer of Damascus? That's it looks like that's going to be my heir. And God says, no, look out now. Go out and look at the stars. See if you can count them. Says that's the way your seed will be. Not your servant. Your seed will be like that. So when he's talking about Isaac, prospectively, the one that's going to be born, then he says, look now, and this is verse 5, tell the stars whether you'd be able to number them. So the subject of Isaac is when stars of heaven is given. Now the last one, Genesis 26:4 there, is after Abraham is gone, and now God appears to Isaac directly. And to Isaac directly, he says, your seed will be like the stars of heaven. He doesn't say that to Jacob on this occasion. He says that to Isaac, because Isaac does represent the spiritual seed. Now, you all know that. Galatians, the fourth chapter, about verse 22 or so. You, brethren, like Isaac was, are children of the promise. And you have a spiritual hope. That spiritual hope is the stars of heaven. So those are the occasions when he uses stars of heaven. Now let's look at what he says to Jacob. This is Genesis 28:14. And in 28:14, he doesn't mention stars. But I'm going to go, you know, even before that, I'm going to go to chapter 13, verses 15 and 16 first. This is before the birth even of Isaac. But Abraham is talking to Abraham about the land he's going to inherit. Now, the occasion here is when Abraham and Lot, they were both had a lot of herds. And, you know, there was a little problem between the herdsmen, you know, this is my area to feed my flock, not yours. And I don't think Lot and Abraham got into difficulty, but their people did. So it's time to divide. And so Abraham, very magnanimous, says, Lot, you look out and tell me where you want to go, and I'll take the other spot. So Lot looked out to the fields across the Jordan Valley, and he says, boy, that looks good. that was before, you know, before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. This was really a fertile plain. Now it's not so much. And so he went there. And, of course, that's a notice to us. Always remember the spiritual promises, not the earthly good things. If we put our confidence in the earthly good things, we're going to end up desolate, like Lot did. There's the great comfort. But we put our hope in spiritual things. So Lot is gone now. And now God appears to Abraham. And this is in chapter 13, we're going to start with verse 14. And the Lord said unto Abram, after the Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place, for you are north, south, east, and west. For all the land which you see, I'm going to give it to you and to your seed after you. And I will make your seed like not the stars of heaven, but the dust of the earth. He's talking about the land here. That's not what you're going to inherit. Okay, in a sense you will, because the righteous shall inherit the earth. That's true. That's part of the Lord's Sermon on the Mount. But you're not going to live here in this area. The people that are going to inhabit those parts that Abraham viewed are going to be his natural descendants, and that is Israel. Now, I'm going to suggest we often think of the stars and the sand of the seashore, the church and the world. But I'm going to suggest there's a third class here, and that is the natural seed of Abraham, that is the Jewish people. The Jewish people are going to receive that land. His descendants are going to receive everything he can see, north, west, south, and east. So I think that's why the dust is used. Now, you know that if Isaac represents the spiritual church, you all probably are familiar with the concept that Jacob might represent the natural seed of Israel. I think that that's true. There are multiple pictures with Jacob. It's not always true. It's not always. But in the sense that he was away from the land of Israel for 20 years, a picture of the gospel age. Then he came back to the land, and he had to face his brother Esau. And he was a really problem with this conflict. And finally, at the dawn of the new day, they embraced, just like at the dawn of the kingdom, there's going to be an embracing with the Arabs and the Israelites. And then, there's a whole story there about Jacob coming back. That's another talk. It's just a whole story. But Jacob there represents the natural seed of Israel. And that's going to be the land they're going to inherit. Now, when you go to Genesis 28:14, and that's when Jacob is being instructed by God. Well, let's see what God says to him. But you already know what it's going to say. It's going to talk about the dust of the earth. 28:14. Your seed will be as the dust of the earth, and you will spread abroad to the west, the east, the north, and the south, just like he told Abraham. And in thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Yes, natural Israel is going to be the agency for extending the blessings of the kingdom to everyone on earth. But of course, your choice, your hope, Your privilege is going to be to supervise the whole thing from the heavenly throne. But mankind will be blessed by Israel here on earth. And I think dust of the earth is specific to Israel. And there, of course, in Genesis 22:17, And again in 32:12, you have the broadest possible scope, the sand of the seashore. Okay, we'll move on from there. So there's three parts to the seed of Abraham. And by the way, there are three ages, can I say, in which all of this takes place. Because you have, in the Jewish age, finally, the nation of Israel was born. And that's the dust of the earth. They're going to be privileged to be servants over here. And then in the gospel age, the stars, and then, of course, in the kingdom, you're going to have the sand of the seashore. So the fruition of the Abrahamic covenant comes in three ages. And those three ages connect with the dust, the stars, and the sand of the seashore. Now, did I miss something? There's something here you want to put?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I always do that. That's trying to have worlds on it.
Okay.
We did have the world on it.
I'm sorry, which voice would you like?
It was a chart that had Isaac, Jacob, and world.
Yeah. Here.
There you go. Okay, there you go. Leave that up for there for just a moment. Okay. So, now, by the way, you know, it's interesting how thoughts and things come about. I've had this opinion for many, many years of these three distinct divisions. And my father told me once, I think it was a talk that I found from my grandfather. I think it was a manuscript of a talk from my grandfather. I read that manuscript and he had exactly the same view. I was very intrigued by that. This is not new, but we don't often talk about it. Okay, I'm going to flip to the next slide. Okay, now when Abraham was told that he was to go into a far land, he was, of course, way over here in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, yesterday we had this same map up here. We augmented that map because this was a different subject. We showed Ecbatana, the city where the Medes were, had as their center of the empire. And then here was Susa, where Shushan, the palaces, and Persepolis down here. But Abraham was in that general area, but he was in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, he had to travel, and he didn't just go direct here. He went across the Fertile Crescent, like most travelers would do that. But, surprisingly, he didn't just go right into Israel, even in that. Please. He went up to the city of Haran, and he stayed there. Now, I think the city of Haran got its name because that's where that was named after Abraham's deceased brother. I think that's why that name is there, and that's where they settled. And they settled there until his father, Terah, had died, and then, after that, he went southward. And you find that in Genesis, the 12th chapter. And then he went southward into the land of Canaan. So that's the route he took. Now, I'm going to suggest that this route is meaningful. Now, that was a really good map. This one is my hand-drawn map, so this is not as good. But I just wanted to highlight only the parts that are meaningful to our point here. There's Ur, where he left. There's Haran, where he stopped. And then he came down to Shechem. And at Shechem, that's where he offered an offering. Not Isaac. Isaac wasn't around then. But he offered an offering at Shechem. This is in Genesis 12th chapter. And then after he finished that, then he went down to Bethel. And then after that, he went down to Egypt for a while. There's another story there. But the only four stopping points he made with respect to this issue, Ur, Haran, Shechem, and Bethel. Now, I'm going to suggest that these four stopping points represent for us four ages in the divine plan. Now, you already know that the whole thing starts here in the patriarchal age. I think that's where Abraham was, in the patriarchal age. And now he's got to leave there, and to develop the seed of Abraham, we're going to go to the Jewish age, and that's the first stopping point at Haran. Now, that's not where the Abrahamic covenant is going to be solidified and the oath made and all that. No, that was a stopping point on the way, and I think the Jewish age was not yet the place where the seed of Abraham really appeared. Now, you all know in Galatians 3:16-17, the seed of Abraham is Christ. Now, we don't even have to interpret that. Paul says that very directly, Galatians 3:16-17. He saith not unto seeds as of many, but unto seed, singular, that's Paul's point, and to thy seed, which is Christ. That's an interpretation Paul makes for us. So we don't have to decide that. That's the issue. Jesus is the seed of Abraham. And then it says in Galatians 3:29, if you be Christ's, then you're Abraham's seed. You're included in this, and you're heirs according to the promise. And then he says in Galatians, a few verses down later, you, brethren, like Isaac was, are children of the promise. So boy, you know, these are some of the fundamental, most remarkable promises you could ever imagine. I'm glad that we don't interpret those. I'm glad that's established in Holy Writ. That's just firm. But before that could ever be done, and before the sacrifice to seal this whole thing was really given, there was a period in Haran before God really confirmed the covenant and before Abraham had fulfilled the conditions of the covenant. You remember he said, when he gave the covenant to Abraham, the promise, if you leave your home and you come to the land that I show you, then, see, it was conditional. But now it's no longer conditional. Once he leaves this place and comes here, it's no longer conditional. Now, I think that this is where Abraham started the patriarchal age, and that Haran represents the Jewish age, and it's still all conditional because we haven't seen the Messiah himself. We haven't seen Jesus appear. Now, it's conditional only because, you know, we haven't seen the progress. It's firm because God has promised it. Okay, in that respect, not. But I think until the Jewish age is finished, we don't yet have the guarantee, the surety of this. And when it is, then the first thing to be offered is the sacrifice at Shechem. Now, this Shechem, I think, represents the beginning of the gospel age. And the sacrifice there represents the sacrifice of Christ. And then the next stopping point, the house of God at Bethel, I think is going to represent for us the next age. That's the Messianic age when finally this is going to go to the whole world of mankind. And that's the end of that kind of picture. They go on to Egypt and you're on to a different subject. Those are the only stopping points mentioned in this context, just those four. And there are exactly four ages involved here. Now, there's a lot of more detail we could talk about and discuss here. I'll just tell you what it might be, and you can study it some other time. But, you know, when you go to the book of Judges, you have seven narratives of the book of Judges to open the Judges. And I think that those seven narratives take you through the gospel age, and that each of those judges represents one of the seven stars in God's right hand, one of the seven messengers. That means that all of these experiences trace of this first seven of the judges trace our experience through the gospel age. We're only going to talk here about one of them, and that is the very first one. And it turns out that the affliction for which Othniel was raised to deliver Israel was the affliction of a man called Cushan-Rishathaim. Very long name. Where did he come from? He came from this area in the north. And may I suggest that the very first affliction that the church experienced was Ishmael persecuting Isaac. Israel, natural Israel, persecuting the spiritual Israel. That's the problem that the burgeoning gospel had at the beginning of the gospel age. They were afflicted by the Jewish leaders. That's why several of the apostles were whipped, beaten, and killed. And now Rome was going to be the big problem in the second phase of the church. But in the first phase, it's the Jewish age, the Jewish leaders. And I think coming from the north, Cushan-Rishathaim pictures that Jewish oppression. That's where the oppression came from. Now you go to the second problem, the second period of the judges. That's a problem that came from the east, and it came and dwelt in Jericho, and the king Eglon actually took up residence in Israel where he doesn't belong, and I think that's the Gnostic heresy and all kinds of other things, okay? But each one of these seven judges, you can trace the experience of the seven stages of the church. The first one was from the north, this area. Now, I think I even know who that person was. There's a whole lot of dispute about that by historians and theologians. But I think we have a clue. But that's for another time. But Cushan-Rishathaim, that's the man. And I think coming from the north, I think represents the Jewish oppression, just like Haran represents the Jewish age. Now, later on, when Isaac was offered, this is back in Genesis 22. And if you look at verse 30, this is after the experience of Isaac being offered, Genesis 22:30. It came to pass after these things, was told Abraham, saying, you know, Milcah, she's born children to thy brother Nahor, who lived up here in the north. And you look at all these children, and guess how many you've got? 12 children. I think that means that after the gospel age is finished, it finds out that Israel, the 12 tribes, they come back into prominence again. Israel is going to be have their share in the blessing of the world when they're regathered during this time. After the church is complete, there'll be an earthly blessing to mankind. Okay, so that's the end of this part. Go on to another section. Now we have three mothers involved. Now you know these three mothers, they're very famous. You know that Sarah was the real mother of Isaac, but you all know the experience before Isaac was born. And you know that this came at the prompting of Sarah. It was Sarah that suggested to Abraham, what you're going to have to do is take my handmaid and have a child. So everybody's going to work. So let's proceed with this. So it wasn't Abraham's choice. It was Hagar's. But if it was Sarah's. But if you look in the laws that were extant in this period of history, you'll find that not only in this culture, but in the Middle East generally, the concept that if you were barren, your handmaid could bear a child in your behalf was there. It was just part of the accepted mode of life. So this wasn't all that odd, a suggestion. In our culture, it would be unthinkable. But in that culture, it was quite different. So Hagar, I think, represents the Jewish law that was a mother to the nation of Israel. And that connects with the dust of the earth and connects with the Jewish age. Sarah, of course, Sarah is our mother. Sarah is the one that bore Isaac. That's related to the stars, and that's the gospel age. Now, these are mentioned by Paul, and this is in the book of Galatians, Galatians the third chapter and the fourth chapter, and you've all studied this, so you know that it's there. And when we come down to Galatians chapter 4, verse 22, it says, it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he was of the bondwoman, was born after the flesh, and the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory? For these are two covenants. The one from Mount Sinai, well, that has to be the Jewish law. I don't know of anybody that disputes that. That's so clear. That's the Jewish law. Was gendereth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. Okay, well, Hagar isn't really a mountain, but I mean, you get the connection thematically. It's connected with the law covenant. And answers to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. Now, I couldn't say that today, but he could say that then, because that was before Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple services were still going on. There was still the Jewish law operating, but then after that, the whole thing ceased. Even today, they don't have offerings in the temple, because there's no temple. The Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all. Now, there's a little possible misunderstanding here. We think in Revelation of New Jerusalem, and sometimes we connect it with this, there is some thematic connection, but not precise. New Jerusalem is the church. The wall is 144 cubits. The foundation are 12 apostles. That is the church. This is different. This, Jerusalem, he says, the one from above is our mother. He's talking about Jerusalem as a mother entity, and in this case, a mother covenant. So what covenant is it that gives us spiritual life? This is debated because Paul didn't tell you precisely. Nobody debates Hagar. But the general answer to this, I think, is the correct answer. Well, Sarah would represent the original covenant that God made with Abraham. Thy seed shall bless all the families of the earth. That's you. That's the spiritual seed. I think that's the spiritual covenant. It's the spiritual part of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, if you just want to say that's the Abrahamic covenant, I wouldn't argue with you, but I might ask you a follow-up question. Will the Abrahamic covenant also bless even the people on earth? Yes, it will. So how do we distinguish the church from the restitution host of mankind? I would say Sarah represents the earth, the spiritual part of the Abrahamic covenant, because there will be an earthly part. Now, with respect to Sarah representing the Abrahamic covenant, that makes sense because she was the wife of Abraham. So I think this connection makes sense. She represents the covenant made with her husband. Now, Hagar was not the wife of Abraham. She was a bondmaid, and that's the point that Paul makes. She was a bondmaid and she gendereth to bondage. And therefore, Israel under the law, under the bondage of the law, that was natural Israel. Now, Paul stops the discussion here and he doesn't talk about Keturah because he looked at the beginning of the gospel age and that was his issue. Here we are at the end and we're kind of interested in Keturah. Who does Keturah represent or is she even part of it? Some would dispute that Keturah is even part of the text because now we have to start our interpretation. So let's follow Paul's lead. If Keturah was a wife of Abraham, now was she? Was Keturah a full wife of Abraham? The answer is, yeah, she was. Well, at least part of the time she was. We'll get to that in just a moment. But after Sarah died, she became the wife of Abraham. She was the wife of Abraham. And now I think she represents the earthly part of the Abrahamic covenant, which will bless the whole world of mankind. Now I say in part she was the full wife. Well, she was after Sarah died. But you know that she's actually called a concubine. You'll find this in Chronicles. Actually, look at my notes here. Let's see. This Chronicles. Let's see.
132.
I'm sorry, would you say that again?
132.
If it's there, sure, we'll go for it, but I thought it was a little bit later. So I read that for us. You have it right there?
Now the sons of Keturah, Abraham's concubine.
There you go. Abraham's concubine. There, that's the one. Very good. Thank you. So she was actually a concubine. Now Carl Hagensick brought this point to my attention years ago. I was a little resistant, but I thought about it and I think he was right. When the six sons of Keturah were born, I believe they were born to her when she was a concubine before Sarah died. And when Sarah died, and now Keturah becomes a full wife, what happened to the status of those six sons? They were elevated. And now these are really sons of a full wife, even though they were born as sons of a concubine. I think that makes some sense in the antipodal picture. Because how many sons were there now? That's another picture. Okay. But for Keturah, six sons of Keturah, representing, I think, the world of mankind born in sin, shaped in iniquity, grew in 6,000 years. I think those six sons, six is deficient of seven, it's sinful. I think these are the people born before the 1,000-year kingdom. These are the people that are born during the period of sin that are going to be relieved, and their status improved when Sarah ends, when the high calling ends and the church is complete. Then Keturah becomes a full wife. Then the status of her sons is improved, and everything gets better for them. And they will be blessed as the earthly seed of Abraham at that time. So I think that Keturah connects with the sand of the seashore. That takes us into the kingdom age. And Keturah was a full wife of Abraham at that time, and therefore I think represents the earthly part of the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, so there's three mothers involved, and they bear children in basically three ages. That is the Jewish age, the gospel age, and the kingdom age. Okay, now we're going to go on to Sarah directly. Sarah was, you know how old Sarah was when she died? Well, if you didn't remember, you know it now. It's right up there. And this is interesting to me. I think somebody has observed that Sarah is the only woman in the entire Old Testament whose age we know when she passed away. I think that's true. Now you go to the New Testament, there's, what is it, Anna the prophetess, something like that, so many years she was a widow. But this is the only one that in the Old Testament that we know for sure. 127 years. Now, you know, when I see a number, I say there's a meaning to that number. Even if I don't know what it is, I suspect there's a meaning to it. I think there's a meaning here. But 127 is what you call a prime number. You can't divide it by anything except the number one in itself. So you can't break it down to see what symbols are it's made of. That's what I do. If I see a number that's suspicious, think there's a meaning there, I divide it into its pieces and see what the pieces add up, either add or multiply. Can't do that with this. But what you can do is recognize that this is 12 tens and 7 ones. So 12 and 7 are really the issue here. Those are both spiritual numbers. The 12 tribes of spiritual Israel. In Revelation, you have 12 times, 1,244. And the seven stages of the church. Both of these are spiritual numbers. Both of them apply to the gospel age calling. So I think even her age is meaningful to us in this respect. Now, there's another woman that you know has something about the spiritual church. That's Esther. And Esther, I think, is a picture of the bride of Christ. Now, Esther was not 127 years old, but she was married to a husband who was very wealthy. Their husband was Ahasuerus. Now, if you're wondering who that is historically, it's the person named Xerxes. Now, yesterday, 2 days ago, we talked about Ezra and Nehemiah in the reign of Artaxerxes. Xerxes was his father. So that's where Xerxes, Ahasuerus, comes in. And Esther represents the bride class. But it says in Esther 1, verse 2, that she was married, the king that she was going to be married to, was Ahasuerus, who was master over 127 provinces. So with respect to the church class, Esther, that same number 127 comes up again. And now there's one more, and that is the experience of Noah. Now, we're going to talk about Noah, the flood experience, and see where this same number comes up with him. But basically, the entire flood experience lasted 127 times 3. From the day he got into the ark to the day he left the ark was 381 days. And we know that the ark represents redemption. You know that because Peter says that. Peter says the ark wherein 8 souls were saved represents the baptism that we undergo now. Now, if you think about getting into the ark, outside the ark was the flood. The flood was a curse. The curse was just destroying everything. But you're safe if you're in the ark, and therefore you're safe in Christ. So I think the ark represents Christ. And I think the whole development of salvation here is connected to this development of the seed of Abraham. And therefore, taking Peter's lead on this, the whole experience in the ark was 3 times 127, perhaps suggesting 3 ages of development overall in the plan that stems from Jesus' sacrifice. Now, I want to talk a little bit just about the experiences in Genesis. This is kind of a sidelight to the talk a little bit. We have a record of the time from Adam until the flood. We have that in Genesis chapter 5, and then onward to chapter 11. Now, if the whole world of mankind looked at that passage and they said, boy, that's right, I think that would be a big improvement over them thinking, yeah, we've been here for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. Things would be much clearer. If people really knew that we've been here for roughly 6,000 years, what would that do to the whole concept of evolution as opposed to direct creation? It would settle the question, wouldn't it? You know that we're in a position now to actually verify the numbers in Genesis with historical documents? Well, how's that possible? Well, here's the way. I didn't come up with this. Somebody else did. It's on the internet, but I read it years ago. I find it pretty intriguing. I'll just tell you the concept. Okay, I won't go through all the details. Here's the concept. What's the earliest civilization that mankind remembers and can dig up from? It's called the Sumerian civilization. And you'll find it, you find it even in Genesis, the Battle of the Kings talks about Sumer. And they actually have found tablet records from Sumer today. And they found a king list. And the king list tells you all the kings that reigned before the flood. And then there's a line that says the flood swept them all away, and then it gives you the other kings. But these kings reigned for ridiculous periods of time. I mean, the first king reigned for 28,800 years. The next king reigned for 36,000 years. The third king reigned for 43,200 years. Something is radically wrong. But you know, there are numerical connections between those numbers and the numbers in Genesis chapter 5. I didn't discover that. Somebody else did, but I really pursued it. I think he's right. You can find it on the internet. If you look at the ages of the patriarchs that lived before the flood, they did live very long. Seth lived 912 years. Canaan lived 905 years. Methuselah lived 969 years. Now take those numbers. And by the way, these kings that ruled before the flood, there's only 8 of them, not 10. Because they don't include the first man. We know that because we know the first man's name, Hadapu, and he's not there in the Sumerian list. And we know the last one. We know the name of they give to Noah, and he's not on this list. So the person that was started perfect and the person that lived through beyond the flood, they're not included, just the 8 ones in between. And if you take the sum of all of the patriarchs' ages and round them off to the nearest 10, you're going to get 66 hundreds and 6 tens. The total ages of all these patriarchs in Genesis are 6,660 years, if you add up all the ages. Now that's a number that the Sumerian civilization would want to remember, because unlike our culture, which we have base 10, they kept their numbers on base 6, and therefore 60 was the basic number. We have 10, they had 60. So their numbers were like a Sar of 3,600 years and a Ner of 600 years. That's just part of the record. We know that. So if you change all of these numbers of their kings to Sars and Ners, guess what you have? The same number of hundreds and tens that we have in Genesis. Now, I won't go through all the details for you. I'd love to. It could be a little thick, a little boring. I'm just going to tell you this. There is a numerical connection between this exorbitant list of the Sumerian kings and the numbers in Genesis chapter 5. That won't work if you go to the Septuagint. But it does work if you go to the Hebrew. There is a numerical connection between those two lists. It's as though these tablets are a correct version of what we've got in the Hebrew text. It really works. I've gone through it with great detail. I'd like to take half an hour more and tell you about it. I'm not going to do that. But I'm just telling you, if you want to look it up, check it out. Email me, I'll tell you more. It really does connect. Okay, now we're going to go back to the flood episode. Here's the flood episode. Now, you may know that when you go to the flood episode in Genesis chapter 7, that it says they entered the ark, and on the seventh day the rain came. And it did. But that seventh day is the first day of the rain, so I'm not going to count that. 6 days they had to wait before the rain came. And then the testimony is that 5 months went by, and we also know the number of days. It was exactly 150 days, so there's no question. That's 150 days before they came to rest. Now, I think that there's a picture here. I think this is a picture of the end of the age. So I think those 5 months maybe represent the gospel age picture. And, you know, when you enter the tabernacle, you enter the gospel age tabernacle, what do you see at the beginning? You see 5 pillars, because 5 is a number for the new creation. So I think this 5 months is also a picture of the development of the new creation. And you come to rest, but the boat has stopped moving, but there's still water everywhere. You look outside, you can't see anything but water everywhere. The curse is still out there. Now, I'm going to give you a suggestion that maybe coming to rest here represents the end of the gospel age in a sense. The curse is still there. Curse is not dry. But we're at the end of the age, which I would put a date on that of 1874. We're at the end of the age according to 1335 days. So they go another 74 days, and they see out in the distance the top of the mountains. If you take 74 years from 1874, what do you get to? 1948. And that's the first tangible sign that we can see in the kingdoms of this world that the flood is going to end, that the curse is going to be dried up. Because with the reestablishment of the nation of Israel, we no longer have to say, by prophecy, we know that Israel will be reestablished. Now we see it. And you know, in Micah, the 4th chapter, at the end of the age, the days will come that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established in the top of the mountains. That's the same language here. They saw the top of the mountain standing above the flood. The first appearance, tangible, of a nation that's going to be the kingdom as things develop. Now, the next period is inferential. I'll talk about that some other time. But finally, they get to the point where they actually see the land. Now, I'm ready to say they see the dry land, except that it's not dry, it's muddy. But they look out, and the water is gone. That's the point. The water is gone. Their curse is gone. I think this represents the time of the kingdom. And if you look in Genesis 8:13, you'll see that it's the first day of the first month of not only a new year, but a new century. Now, you remember earlier we just mentioned almost in passing that in Exodus, when the tabernacle was established, it was on the first day of the first month of a brand new year. I don't think that's coincidental. God said, wait till that day comes before you set up the tabernacle. The tabernacle represents the gospel age. So when the gospel age began, it's represented as the first day of the new year. Now, when the flood is dried, it's still muddy, but the flood, but the water's gone. It's at the first day of a brand new year. And I think this is meaningful, of a new age commencing. But they can't get out of the ark yet, because even though the water's gone, they won't die if they get out. It's still very muddy. And what we have in the kingdom are the effects of sin and death that are still with us even after the curse is removed. The curse will be removed by the application of the blood of Christ. Does that mean everybody's perfect? Of course not. They still have to remain in Christ, in the ark, because it's muddy out there. How long is it muddy? 56 days. There's no, that's very clear in the record. 56 days. 56, now this is where you break down a number. How do you get 56? Break it down into two numbers. Sonia, what is 56? What times what?
Oh, eight times.
You got the seven and the eight. You got them both?
Yeah.
You got both, Sonia? I asked you because you're a numbers person. I knew you'd get it. Seven times eight. You remember when the kingdom starts in Micah 5:5, he will raise seven kings and eight princes to deliver Israel. And I think through the testimony of the church, the seven, and the ancient worthies, the eight, that mankind is going to be prepared to shed off all of the influences of sin, all the mud of the old situation, and they will live forever. And once they've done that, at the end of the kingdom, can they get out of the ark now? Yes. Because there's no danger, they are now perfect. They are no longer required to stay under the atonement of Christ. They're thankful for that forever. But now they're independently perfect. They get out of the ark and the new world begins. But the total period of time involved here, 381 days. Three times 127. Okay, we're going to summarize and conclude. Summary. The Abrahamic promise is secured by the ransom. You remember when Jesus, when God swore by an oath that this covenant would be firm? That was on the occasion of Isaac being offered by Abraham. And I think the point of that surety was that the ransom, the sacrifice of Jesus, is what assures the fulfillment of this plan. I know some brethren who have given up their faith. I have the same feeling. How could that be? We have the oath of God himself involved in this. It was secured by the ransom, and that was successful. Number two, the three elements that describe the seed of Abraham, stars, dust, and sand, I think represent something vital in the accomplishment of this purpose. The heavenly seed, the most important, that would be Christ in the church. Israel, the dust of the earth, those that are actually going to inherit what Abraham could see, north, west, east, and south, that's their land by promise. And the whole world of mankind as the sand of the seashore, the broadest domain of all. God's plan includes every person who has ever lived. The journey that Abraham made, starting with Ur of the Chaldees, to Haran, to Shechem, to Bethel, perhaps represents we have to leave the patriarchal age for this to take root. In the Jewish age, we began to have the Hagar seed developed, pointing forward to the gospel age, Shechem, and finally to the millennial age at Bethel. We've seen that there were three mothers involved in the development of this promise. Sarah, the Abrahamic covenant, the spiritual part. Keturah, the Abrahamic covenant, the earthly part. Hagar, the law covenant, a covenant of bondage. And finally, suggesting that even the numbers involved, 12, 10s, and 7 ones really tell us something about how this promise is going to be developed through the spiritual seed of Christ. That would be Jesus and the church. But dear brethren, we have the testimony of God firm and unshakable. Let us never quail in our faith about what is right that God is going to do for the world and mankind, or our share in it. Remember, we're not interpreting when we read the book of Galatians. And Paul affirms to us, if you be Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Let that assurance always give us confidence, not in ourselves, but in the purposes and the ability of God to fulfill them. And if we are faithful, then we can be part of this.